Ever hear a story that just feels fundamentally unfair? A real David versus Goliath situation? Well, that's exactly where we're headed in this deep dive, into the landmark case of Williams v. Walker Thomas Furniture Co. Picture Oralee Williams, a single mother with seven children, trying to make ends meet on a monthly income of just $218.
And this isn't just a heart-tugging story, although it certainly is that. We're using this case as our lens to really understand some crucial aspects of contract law.
Right.
Specifically, we're going to explore why the initial legal decisions actually sided with the furniture company, a result that seems, you know, on the face of it, deeply unjust.
Absolutely. To get to the heart of this, we've gathered a really insightful set of materials. Think of it as your shortcut to understanding the core of this case.
Okay.
We've got analysis of what makes this case so important, how the story unfolded in court, the key legal nuances you absolutely need to grasp, and even some examples of the legal arguments involved.
Our goal today is straightforward, especially for those of you heading into the legal field. We aim to dissect the legal reasoning that underpinned that initial ruling.
Correct.
Why did the court seemingly permit what many would view as a profoundly unfair outcome? And what are the long-term implications of this case for how we understand contract law today?
Okay, so let's paint a picture of the situation. Walker Thomas Furniture Co. had a very specific business model built around installment payment plans.
Mm-hmm.
They kept legal ownership of everything you bought until every single...
Not entirely. Here's where things get really interesting. They employed what was known as a cross-collateralization clause. Imagine buying a washing machine, then a television, and then a sofa, all on separate payment schedules. This clause stipulated that any payment you made wasn't solely for the latest item.
Right.
Instead, it was applied proportionally across all your outstanding balances, even going back to that very first washing machine.
Wow. So what was the practical effect of this? It created a real potential for a debt trap.
Exactly.
Every new purchase essentially resecured all the old debt.
Huh.
And the truly precarious part was this. If you missed even a single payment on the newest, perhaps cheapest item,
mm-hmm.
Walker Thomas had the legal right to repossess everything you had ever bought from them, even if you had nearly finished paying for those older, more expensive items.
Precisely. And for Oralee Williams, this wasn't some abstract legal concept.
Mm.
Between 1957 and 1962, she purchased multiple essential household items from Walker Thomas under this exact arrangement.
Right, just trying to furnish her home.
Think about the reality, a mother of seven trying to furnish her home piece by piece. This all culminated in April of 1962 when she bought a stereo, which unfortunately increased her total outstanding balance to a considerable $678.
Then, tragically, Williams defaulted on her payments.
Mm-hmm.
And Walker Thomas's reaction wasn't just to go after the stereo. They initiated a legal action, a replevin action, to repossess all the items she had purchased from them, dating all the way back to 1957.
Everything. So, years of payments and essential household goods were at risk due to a more recent, relatively smaller debt.
Yeah, exactly.
And at the initial trial court level, the decision went in favor of Walker Thomas. The court upheld the contract, seemingly allowing the furniture company to take back everything.
Okay.
Now, this is a really critical point to grasp, and it's something that's often misunderstood. This initial ruling was subsequently appealed.
That's right. And this is where we need to be absolutely clear on the sequence of events. The D.C. Court of Appeals took up the case in 1964. And what's particularly noteworthy here is, well, that court actually affirmed the trial court's decision.
Exactly. People often miss that. What's important to note is that in this 1964 appeal, the court did not send the case back to the lower court based on the argument that the contract was unconscionable, that it was so unfair it shouldn't be enforced.
Ah, okay.
That more detailed examination of unconscionability would come later. At this stage, in 1964, the appellate court agreed with the trial court that the contract should be upheld.
So, if they didn't rule based on this idea of unconscionability at this point, what was the central legal question the court was grappling with in 1964? What was the core legal puzzle they were trying to solve?
Well, this raises a fundamental question about contract law at the time. It wasn't explicitly about this specific legal doctrine of unconscionability yet.
Okay.
Instead, the key legal issue in 1964 was more basic. Can a contract be deemed invalid simply because there was a significant power imbalance between the two parties involved, or because the terms seemed excessively unfair to one party, even if there was no proof of outright fraud or intentional misrepresentation by the more powerful party?
So the court wasn't primarily looking at whether the deal felt morally wrong. They were asking, Does the existing law provide grounds to invalidate a contract just because one person appeared to have gotten a very bad deal?
Precisely. And to answer that, the court relied on a well-established legal principle.
The duty to read.
The duty to read.
Right.
The prevailing legal understanding was that when you sign a contract, you are generally bound by all of its terms, regardless of whether you actually read them thoroughly or fully grasped their implications.
So if Williams didn't read or didn't fully understand the ramifications of that cross-collateralization clause, the court's position was essentially, well, she signed the document. The responsibility to understand it was hers.
That's the sometimes harsh reality of the duty to read.
Mm.
The court essentially concluded that Williams's lack of understanding what they might have legally termed a unilateral mistake, meaning only one party was mistaken about the terms, wasn't sufficient to invalidate the contract.
Right.
Unless Walker Thomas had actively deceived her or misrepresented the terms of the agreement, the legal burden was on Williams to understand what she was agreeing to.
Now, here's where things become really interesting and where the tension in this case really emerges. Let's delve into the court's reasoning, specifically Judge Quinn's majority opinion. Because what's striking is the apparent contradiction within it.
It is striking. What's fascinating here is the almost palpable sense of conflict in Judge Quinn's words. He didn't hesitate to strongly criticize Walker Thomas's business practices.
No kidding.
He used forceful language, describing them as irresponsible and even exploitative, particularly given that Walker Thomas was well aware of Mrs. Williams's extremely limited financial resources.
So the court called Walker Thomas irresponsible and exploitative, but still let them take Williams' furniture. It seems like a direct contradiction.
Exactly. Quinn's opinion is really a compelling example of judicial frustration. He essentially stated, in legal terms, this situation is abhorrent, but my ability as a judge to intervene is constrained by the existing law in the District of Columbia.
Wow.
Current legal precedent simply doesn't offer a basis to overturn this contract on these grounds alone. It's up to the legislative branch, Congress, to enact laws that would address such injustices.
Wow. So the court clearly recognized the unfairness, but felt legally unable to act within the existing legal framework. That's a pretty stark and significant admission.
It is, and it underscores a fundamental aspect of the judicial role. Generally, courts are tasked with interpreting and applying the law as it currently exists, not necessarily with creating new law based solely on their own sense of fairness or equity.
Right. Apply, don't create.
Judge Quinn specifically pointed to the absence of consumer protection legislation in the District of Columbia at that particular time.
And in his written opinion, he even referenced the state of Maryland, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He specifically mentioned Maryland's Retail Installment Sales Act.
He did.
As an example of potential legislation that could effectively address these kinds of exploitative situations and offer protection to consumers.
Correct. He held up Maryland's legislation as a potential model. If similar laws had been in place in D.C., the legal outcome for Ora Lee Williams might have been very different.
Right.
The court, in essence, passed the responsibility to the legislature, urging them to step in and create the necessary legal mechanisms to shield vulnerable consumers from such contractual arrangements.
So we're left with this real conflict, aren't we? The strong moral disapproval from the court is evident.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't oblivious to the inherent unfairness,
mm-hmm.
yet they feel legally compelled to uphold this contract based on the prevailing legal principles. It's a difficult legal reality to reconcile.
This very conflict, this dissonance between the perceived injustice and the legal outcome, is precisely what makes this seemingly unfavorable ruling so significant in the long run.
How so?
It powerfully highlighted a deficiency in the existing legal framework. It starkly illustrated the limitations of judicial intervention in cases involving unequal bargaining power and potentially unconscionable contract terms when clear legal principles or statutes addressing these issues were absent.
And this case, even though it initially went against Williams, ultimately served as a really important catalyst for legal change, didn't it? It wasn't the final word on how the law would approach these types of situations.
Absolutely not. If we connect this to the broader evolution of contract law, this case played a pivotal role in the subsequent development and widespread adoption of Uniform Commercial Code, UCC, Section 2302.
Okay, UCC 2302.
Which specifically deals with the concept of unconscionability in contract law. While the 1964 D.C. Court of Appeals didn't explicitly base its ruling on unconscionability, the compelling facts of the Williams case and the court's own expressed frustration significantly contributed to the growing recognition of the need for this legal principle to be more robustly applied in other jurisdictions.
Got it. And the UCC, just quickly.
Right. The UCC, for those who may not know, is a standardized set of laws governing commercial transactions that has been adopted in whole or in part by all 50 U.S. states. Mm. Section 2302 specifically gives courts the power to refuse to enforce contracts or specific clauses within contracts that are deemed to be unconscionable.
So it's as if this case, in its initial outcome, starkly demonstrated why the legal concept of unconscionability needed to be more firmly established and readily applicable.
Exactly.
It's a powerful reminder of the law's limitations in addressing power imbalances when those limits aren't clearly defined by legislation or established legal principles.
Precisely. And while there was a subsequent 1965 D.C. Circuit opinion in this very case that did delve more deeply into the issue of unconscionability and ultimately remanded the case.
So it did get remanded later.
Yes, in 1965 by the Circuit Court. But our primary focus here has been to understand the foundational 1964 ruling and the legal reasoning behind that court's decision based on the legal landscape at that specific point in time. This 1964 ruling really laid bare the problem that needed to be addressed.
Okay, that clarification is helpful. So to summarize the key takeaway from this 1964 ruling we've focused on, despite the court clearly acknowledging just how exploitative these contract terms were and how incredibly vulnerable Orrell Lee Williams was, they ultimately upheld the agreement. Their legal reasoning hinged on existing legal principles, most notably the duty to read and the absence of any legal proof of fraud or intentional misrepresentation on the part of Walker Thomas.
And it's absolutely crucial to remember the broader significance of this initial ruling. This case, while representing a setback for Orrell Lee Williams in the immediate term, became a powerful and influential illustration of the pressing need for stronger consumer protection laws.
Right.
It forced a direct confrontation with the inherent limitations of traditional contract law in adequately addressing situations of significant power imbalances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it ultimately played a vital role in the evolution and wider acceptance of the unconscionability doctrine in American legal thought. This case is a prime example of why your contracts professor likely emphasizes the concepts of procedural and substantive unconscionability. It's a real-world illustration of the law's journey in trying to balance the sanctity of contracts with fundamental fairness.
So as you reflect on this deep dive into the initial ruling of Williams v. Walker Thomas, it really prompts some important considerations, especially for those of you studying law. How do you see the necessary balance between this fundamental principle of freedom of contract, the idea that individuals should generally be free to enter into agreements, and the very real societal need to protect vulnerable individuals from potentially exploitative terms in today's complex economic environment?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It really is. What role do you believe the law should play in addressing those inherent power imbalances that can so often exist in contractual relationships? It's definitely a critical area to continue exploring, particularly as you delve further into legal concepts like UCC Section 2302 and the ongoing evolution of consumer protection laws.